Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club's Marin Conversations. I'm Bruce Robbie. I'm the CEO of Relevant Wealth Advisors here in Mill Valley. And I'm also on the Board of Governors of the Commonwealth Club. So one of my passions is bringing the Commonwealth Club events to Marin. And that's what we've been doing for about 4 years here. So thank you for joining us. Let's see, how many of people here in the room tonight eat food? Okay, great. Well, you've come to the right talk. So I want to introduce our speakers tonight. Paul Dolan is the former president of the Wine Institute and Fetzer Vineyards. And he's a pioneer in biodynamic farming. I think you were at Fetzer for 27 years. Did I make that up? Yeah. Now he has his own vineyard up in Ukiah, about 70 acres. And then he's also running Truett and Hurst in his free time. And he was nice enough to bring the wine tonight. So thank you. It's a delicious wine from Truett and Hurst tonight. Thank you. Michael Dimmick is internationally recognized as a thought leader, organizer, and advocate for the transformation of food and farming systems. That sounds really important. And currently, Michael is the president of Roots of Change. I took a look at their website, rootsofchange.org. They're doing some really powerful things in changing the way we grow food primarily in our state, and hopefully we will be the seed that moves across the country. So take a look at Michael's website if you have a few moments, and if you want to make a donation, it's an opportunity for that too. So on that note, I'm going to shut up and hand it over to Michael, who will begin tonight's conversation. Thank you very much for coming.
Good evening. Very nice to see you all. Thank you, Bruce, and thank you, Diane, for working with us to get this all set up. It's a great pleasure. There are a lot of people actually out there that I recognize and have had a chance to touch base with a few, and really appreciate you showing up tonight. Marin County obviously is a fantastic place to have a conversation like this. John Wicks is in the room, and he's one of the great ranchers in the country that is doing some of the stuff we're going to get into. So it's nice to have you here as a beacon of light for us. So and hope people will introduce themselves. So we're going to have a conversation tonight with one of the great pioneers, one of the people that I learned about early in my life, Paul Dolan, who has been a great source of information and knowledge for me. I've had many good conversations through the years, and so we're going to have another one tonight. I think what we should start with, because we had a little chance to touch base the other day about this evening, and we both were commenting on the title of the talk, Farming to Save the Earth. And when you first see that, you might think that's very hyperbolic, it might seem to some people. In fact, I had someone mention it to me. So anyway, what were your first thoughts when you saw the title?
Well, actually, to be honest with you, I'm not sure that I shared this with you the other day. Actually, my personal commitment in life is to create a shift in the sustainability of the planet through agriculture. And I've been organizing myself around that for a long time. Actually, 20 years ago, it was to create a shift in the sustainability of the planet through business leadership. So I got very involved in the framework and the development of sustainability in the wine business. And probably some of you may know that the wine business actually took a real strong leadership position around sustainability, and we wrote a code of sustainable wine growing practices back 20 years ago now. And there's over 70% of the wineries and the grape growers in California are now engaged in this process of rating oneself as a self-assessment guide. And the reason I got so involved with that was because I was doing it with my company. I had this particular passion for running a company that was committed to environmental and social responsibility and made great wine. That was sort of my mantra, if you will. And inside of that time frame, we explored what did that mean and how would that show up. And we ended up designing or organizing our company around the triple bottom line, which we called E3, social equity, environmental, and economics. And from there, I've continued to explore in my life, and my great passion now is agriculture. And so essentially that's And that's why Michael and I are here, because we're going to talk about agriculture. So that's
so,
what comes to mind.
Yeah, I'm curious about why you think what you know. Do you know what it is in your character or your process of thinking about the world that you know? Why did you become interested in sustainability? What was the first impulse that brought you to start thinking about it?
Well, let me see. When I started out in life, what I really wanted to do was something that was just really fun, and I decided that winemaking would be fun. It would be an artistic endeavor, and I've been blessed to be in the wine business, no question about it. It's just been fantastic for me. And in those very early years, I can remember being in one particular vineyard. It was a Sauvignon Blanc vineyard, and tasting fruit. And as a winemaker, that's what we did. We usually made our decisions based on taste, not so much based on chemistry or analytics. And I can remember being in one vineyard, tasting the fruit off of one Sauvignon Blanc vine, and it had all of the fruit and melon and fig characteristics that I'd expect for Sauvignon Blanc. And then just walking 10 feet over, tasting a berry off another vine, and found it to be flat and insipid. And I didn't get that. I didn't understand why that was. And I would always have great hopes for that wine, but each year it would end up going into our everyday table wine. But 3 years after we converted that vineyard to organic, those same grapes went into our top-level Sauvignon Blanc. So what I discovered for myself was, one, I could make better wine if I took the chemicals out and I farmed organically. And the other one was I realized that I must have been doing something negative to the vineyard, and probably negative, I assessed that it was probably to the microbial life in the soil. And then I started to realize that when the rains came, they probably washed the residue of those chemicals downstream into somebody else's property. So I realized, I came to the awareness that my business wasn't isolated. I wasn't alone, and the things that I did made a difference, good or bad, and I could expand my awareness on that. So I started down that path of kind of challenging my assumptions and exploring in different areas. So I went from organic to biodynamic, to sustainability, to now what the term and the framework and the paradigm I look at is regenerative farming.
So one thing that I don't know if everybody knows this about you, but you were born into a winemaking family that goes way back. How many people remember Italian Swiss Colony? So that was his family. And Ken Cannon,
you have to be a certain age to be able to put your hand up.
I remember. How many people remember the commercials on TV? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, there's a legacy there, and it'd be interesting to know when Italian Swiss Colony was started, and they were growing grapes up in Northern Sonoma. How were they growing grapes then? Were they growing grapes like you were growing them in the 90s or the 80s, or were they growing them differently early on, 50s, 60s?
Well, they started growing grapes in 1881.
Okay.
So I don't know how they managed to grow them back then. There really wasn't, it was pretty early before the advent of chemical farming and synthetic fertility and nitrogen. But they were really very simple vines. They were head-trained vines. They were a mixture of different red varietals for the most part. Most of them were cuttings that came from Europe, and but I can't tell you that my great grandfather were organic farmers. I just don't believe that was probably the case, and they probably didn't know that was a possibility. And so for me, even though I'm a fourth generation winemaker in my family, actually on both my mother's side and my father's side, interestingly enough. There wasn't an operation for me to go to. They had sold the businesses before I came on the scene demonstrating interest in wine. So I just went off and explored Fetzer. 27 years, it's a pretty long time. But it was a great opportunity there because the family was really very open to the idea of farming organically. And I didn't know we were going to actually, this is kind of fun going down this path, but in the mid-80s, the Fetzer family had hired a fellow named Michael Maltus, who was an organic gardener. He was the organic gardener of the year in 1985 for the Organic Gardening magazine. How many times can you say organic, right? And he was really an inspiration to me. The fact that he was growing, we had about a 5-acre garden at the time, grew about 1,000 different varieties of fruits, vegetables, herbs, and edible flowers. And he had this particular method of farming, sort of bio-intensive, if you will. But he was the one that it caused me to think that there was something else other than another way to make wine, another way to farm than what I thought was the only way. And that's when his inspiration inspired me by virtue of the nature of the quality of the fruit and vegetables that he was growing. It was just amazing. And
I remember that garden. Actually, the first time I ever actually talked to you was in that garden.
Is that right?
That's a long time ago.
Wow,
yeah.
That was a long time ago. Yeah, inspiration.
Has anybody else here ever been up to that garden, the Fetzer Garden?
Yeah,
it was a beautiful garden.
So that started.
So that was
that
was a key moment.
That's a very
key moment. So I think what we're going to get into talking about regenerative farming, which is really the term you're using now, and you're part of a very interesting project we can get into a little bit later. But let's start with this. Why don't you break down for folks a little bit the journey you took from sustainability to organic to biodynamic to regenerative? Like, what were the steps? What were key things that moved you from one place to the next?
Well, when I started down the path of the sustainability, it was that, as I said earlier, I wanted to run a business differently. I came out of winemaking, and I had the opportunity to run the company, and I knew that I wanted to do something different, and I knew that I wanted to make a difference, and I wanted to make a contribution. That's just how it showed up for me. And so I took my business team, you know, the head of sales and finance and so on and so forth, and we went out in the woods and spent 3 days together, and we explored what's our purpose. And we decided that our purpose was to enhance the quality of life. That was the purpose of our business, which is not normally something you'd hear from a business guy, you know. It's like, what? And so, of course, when I came down from the mountain, so to speak, in the woods, and stood in front of the 400 people that worked for me, and I was carrying the tablets, so to speak, and I said, we're going to enhance the quality of life. They thought we were doing something other than drinking wine up there. So, but that really opened up a whole new possibility. So we just explored that statement, our mission statement, and we had to find a way of living that and expressing that. And that's where we came up with the triple bottom line. And we organized the company around three different sets of strategies, one around economics, one around the environment, and one around community and our people. And that then became the framework for the California Wine Institute's program, is this triple bottom line approach and what we were doing at Fetzer.
So then you moved, then you went to organic because you had that experience with the organic gardener.
Right. Then we started to explore what could we do as far as organics, and we created the brand Bonterra. And Bonterra is still alive and well and kicking and making some really beautiful, great wines from up there in Mendocino County. So it's 100% organic. Once again, we went out into the market. Nobody was making organic wines. I mean, people just shook their heads. But I was so passionate about it, they just couldn't say no to me. So they'd, you know, buy a case, and then they maybe buy another case. So eventually it worked beautifully. But in each case, as I've gone through this, for me, it's sort of an exploration process. I felt like there was more to farming than organic. And I was just talking to Mela down in the back here. She has a beautiful biodynamic vineyard out on the coast that... we had a mutual colleague who passed away 5 or 6 years ago now, Alan York, who was really the leader of the biodynamic movement when it came to grape growing. And he was just an amazing inspiration. And so Alan and I would spend a lot of time together, and he invited me to a study group, and, you know, sort of the rest is history. I was just caught hook, line, and sinker. I want to say one little story there. So reading Rudolf Steiner, who's the founder of biodynamics, it's really tough. It's not just, it's tough sledding. It's just not easy. And So I got my little book, and I was so proud, and I thought, I'm going to read, and I'm going to be ready for the study group the next day. And when I quickly realized that you can't prepare a day ahead, it's like a month ahead, even if it's 10 pages, one little chapter. And so I read it four times, and I made my notes, and I was ready to go. And I got there to the study group, and after about 15 minutes of discussion, I thought to myself, I'm not sure if I read the same book they read. So it's just, and yeah, so Alan became our guide, and he kind of walked us through these amazing distinctions, I'll call them, on how to hold a farm and how to hold the possibility to farm. He's the one who taught me the context that you're listening for the farm. You're listening for the farm to show up. You're listening for the farm to express itself. You're listening for the farm to tell you what it needs. And it's a very different way of engaging in farming. And so it's really all about expanding one's consciousness and awareness of what is happening on the farm so that you can provide and you can be that that steward to the property.
So that's a good place to go. Dark Horse Vineyard, you have several properties up near Ukiah, east of Ukiah, in the Dry Creek Valley, right? It's a beautiful, along the Dry Creek there. Beautiful place, and I've been on a lot of farms in my life, and I remember when I went onto your farm, I was like, wow, you can really feel and see diversity, kind of a vigorous plant life. There were tons of birds. I remember we were looking at bluebirds. There were a lot of bluebirds using I think it was the junipers or some. There was a plant there they were really into that you were telling me about. And there was a compost pile, waterworks, hedgerows, a lot of very cool stuff on a hillside, beautiful. And so I think it would be interesting for you to just talk about the life of the farm. What, you know, the way you were getting into it there, it's a living thing. And how it expresses its personality, and what you've done to cultivate that or to support that.
It is a really absolutely stunning, beautiful place. The vegetation is just fantastic, and the topography is gorgeous. And it's 160 acres, and you come off the. It's up in Ukiah. It's a west-southwest facing property. It's a mountain property, so you start at the bottom of the hill and you kind of work your way up through the oak woodlands, oaks, madrones, and manzanita, and we have pastures all along the way on the way up the hill. So we have sheep and cattle. I say cattle. We have two cows, but we call them cattle, and goats at times. We have free range chickens, and as you go up through this woodland, it just invites you. It's really very inviting. It's a little mysterious because you are wandering through and you don't know what's around the next corner. And you come up to the first plateau, and we have a beautiful 10-acre vineyard there, and we call it the barn block because the horse barn is there, and we have a few horses that we use for fun. And then we have this beautiful, what I call a natural insectary area, where we have this huge fir grove. It's probably 150 fir trees. And we built a sort of botanical gardens in that area there. And then from there, we dropped back down the hill and the pathway down to the horse barn, and we pass the horse stables, and then we work our way on up past the pond. So we capture water just using the runoff, sheet runoff from the hillside to use for irrigation. Although we're now at the point where we're not irrigating, we're dry farmed, which is really quite unusual for a hillside mountain vineyard that is using permanent cover, which is craziness in farming. As we wander up, we have a lot of birds on the property, primarily because we created these little safe havens for the birds to be able to go from tree to tree to tree. So we planted a lot of olive trees, and we have some beautiful olive groves along the way. And pasture. So we pasture sheep there in the off-season. We just took them down out of the vineyard because they can be up there during the off-season, and we brought them down into the pastures. And then we work our way on up to the top of the hill, and we have 60 acres of all red grapes. So we have Cabernet and Zinfandel, Petite Syrah, Syrah, and Grenache on this mountain piece. So it rises about 700 or 800 feet from the bottom to the top. And the vineyards, and some of the vineyards are quite steep. They're 30% grade, which are terraced, and the rest of them run up and down the hill. So it takes time to develop a biodynamic vineyard in the way we wanted to do it. We felt that it was important to find a way to get the roots to send their shoots down deep. And so we farm in a particular way where we're always removing the roots every 3 years, the top roots, so that the vine gets the message that Jesus, I need to go down deeper. So we know our roots on this mountain vineyard are probably 20 feet deep, at least at this stage of the game. So for us, it allows us to, one, it's, I believe, extract the full expression of the property by virtue of those really deep roots. And the other thing is we found that we can use cover, it was just 4 years ago, and it became part of my exploration of how can I do what those cattle guys do in that close grazing process? How can I learn from them? Because I think that's the ultimate example of truly regenerative agriculture, truly regenerative farming. So
explain what you mean by
that. Yeah. So the example I use is, we all probably watched a lot of Westerns in our day, and you remember all of the buffalo that used to roam. You know, we don't see too much in these days. But there's this natural rhythm that occurred in the 1800s, we'll call it 1800s, and way past, way back, where these big herds would roam the plains, not only in this country but in other countries. Somebody Steve asked me about Africa, and he was talking about the buffalo in Africa. So when these large herds roam, they just eat everything in their way. There's hundreds of thousands, even a million ahead in some of these herds. And as they ate, they would, of course, defecate, and then their hooves would work up the ground, and we'd be pushing that organic matter down into the soil. And it was that makeup of that kind of organic matter, that kind of impact, that created an environment for perennial grasses to grow. Most of the grasses on the plains these days are annual grasses. So the stability that the perennial grasses created was unique. And actually plains are probably store more carbon than probably any other ecosystem, because they're constantly pulling carbon down out of the cosmic and into the plant, and it works its way down into the roots. Then the mycorrhizal fungi work on the roots, and they're sloughing food for microbes back into the soil. So there's this beautiful natural cycle that exists in that kind of dynamic where animals are grazing. Now today, we don't have the buffalo, but what farmers have discovered is that you can mimic what the buffalo did in those earlier days by creating a method of moving your animals into small spaces, not tight spaces, but smaller spaces, where they would maybe eat for a couple hours or maybe the day, and then you pull down a little electric wire, and then they move into the next spot. That process is amazingly transformative as to what you can do to build organic matter in the soil naturally, just using what we have available that's free, if you will. It's the carbon in the air that's pulled down into, as I described, through the plant. The microbes break down that carbon, and they break down the organic matter into humus, which then provides the nutrient force for the plants to continue to propagate and then ultimately grow more forage, which allows them to pull down more carbon.
So you started with the fact that you saw this and you wanted to do something similar with your vineyard.
Yes. And I kept saying, I can't do it. It's just not possible. There's no way to do that. And so I continue to pursue different ideas and different concepts as how you could actually do that in a vineyard. And I realized that Alan York had put me on a path of this process of removing the roots under the vine causes my roots to go down deep. And I thought, well, I'm just going to have to test it. And so about 5 years ago, I started to leave the cover crop, natural cover, on in the vineyard. And we didn't disc it and we didn't cultivate it. Because when you cultivate, you open the soil up, exposes the carbon burns up, and it goes back up into the atmosphere again. So we're just contributing to that, all that CO2 that we know that's a problem today. I lived in the space of believing that we needed to cultivate because we needed to reduce the competition, the competitive plants in the vine row so that they didn't compete with the plants themselves, the grapevines themselves. And I came to the realization that that's not true. If we institute different practices, we can create a different environment that allows for one to do that. And I also realized that I didn't need to irrigate any longer either. So I was irrigated. I irrigated for 20 years. I cultivated for 20 years. And one day I just stopped and the vines were fine. And on top of that, these last 3 years, I've had the biggest crops I've ever had. So go figure. It's just the craziest thing.
Well, what I'm hearing, a couple things. One, it's the attention, it's the intention to try and work with nature in a way that gets that natural cycle that evolution developed over millions and millions of years, billions of years. So it's an intention, but it's also an awareness, ability, an interest in. And this is, I think, what you and I have talked about in the past. Rudolf Steiner, one of the things that he really brought was this idea of how you look at things and how you open your mind to look at things differently. Because our big challenge is that we have an industrial model of agriculture. We tried to turn farms into factories, and there are consequences. You destroy all the diversity. You degrade the soil. You get dependent, as you've talked about, on inputs, right? So what I'm hearing you say is that by observing in a certain way and adapting, you don't have to do those things that we've believed. So talk about the awareness. Like, what is that? What do you mean by awareness? Because you've used that term in the past.
Well, let me say a couple of things here first. So, I'm going to suggest that the paradigm of farming today is extraction. It's just extractive. We see the soil as a substrate. We put synthetics on it. We remove more nutrients, more elements through harvesting, and then the next year you go back and do it again. So, conventional farmers use synthetics. They use synthetic nitrogen in order to replace what's been removed. And in organic farming, we use natural materials. So we make compost. We plant legumes, cover crop that extract nitrogen from the air, build nitrogen into the soil. We graze animals so we can get their natural manure in the vineyards. Then biodynamic would be the next step for us. And in biodynamics, we farm on a base of organic, so we use just natural materials. We don't use any chemicals. But in biodynamic farming, the framework for us there is that we believe that there's more than nutrients and elements that have been removed. We say that there's a life energy that's been removed from the soil. So we use we call them preparations, certain plant-animal mixtures that we put on the soil or we put on the plants themselves in order to put that life energy back into the soil. And I would sort of say simply that it's biodynamics, organics, regenerative is a larger cloak, is really organized around farming in service of life, not in service of consumption, not in service of extraction, not in service of, we recognize that we're here for the planet. The planet's not here just for us to take from. So it's a very different framework and a very different mindset. The other one, actually, John sort of inspired this in me. So I have a young daughter that's inspired me to create this sort of metaphor and this framework. So I like to say that raising a biodynamic vine is like raising a child, in the sense that in biodynamic farming, we believe that it's not about the vine, it's about the health of the space in which you grow. So with our children, when they're young, there's some opportunity for management and control. But really, what we really have to offer our children is the contribution of a particular environment, a particular space for them to be able to choose and explore. So we can feed them well, we can feed them organic, give them a chance to go to good schools, to live in good neighborhoods, to have good choices of art or music or whatever it is that they, sports, whatever that they choose. And in the end of the day, our greatest hope is that they, as they grow up, they're fully expressed and happy. Well, it's the same thing for a grapevine. The energy and the dynamic is not around the child or the vine. It's really around the space in which the vine grows. So we pay a lot of attention to the health of the microbes beneath the soil. We pay a lot of attention to the flora and fauna on the farm itself. So throughout the farm, I have what I call a bug highway, a bug farm, and a bug strip. So there's these avenues, if you will, of insectary plants that bring insects, and we plant nectar plants, and they attract different types of insects. It creates the balance so that we don't have to use the pesticides. So we find that, and Michael mentioned the bluebirds. We have a flock of bluebirds. And you know, they don't usually hang out in flocks, but we have so many up there. But when you create that kind of environment, you're drawing in a large diversity of birds and insects and small mammals. And it's all part of the life. It's all part of farming in service of the life of the farm.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
Well, it reminds me, the big change that seems to be coming about, hopefully, and when we get to the Q&A, I'll be interested with people. There are a lot of people in this room who know a lot about these things and what's emergent. The thing that really struck me as I listened to you, and every time I hear you talk like this about what you're doing, it reminds me a lot about the framework, the paradigm of Native Americans, in the sense that Native Americans looked at the land as a place and in which they worked with the life that was there, because that was how they could sustain their lives, their civilizations, their communities. And it's a completely different focus and approach than we have now in the dominant farming system. I mean, you're really talking about working with nature and an awareness, an appreciation for nature, like a reverence for it. Which is so counter to the system that's been developed over the last 100 years, 80 years. So, you know, the title of this talk is Farming to Save the Earth. And I want us to kind of get into that. We have 10 more minutes. So I want to talk, before we get to Q&A, so I want to have you talk about why this is so important, that it's happening on the farm, that people are thinking this way about the farms, and what the implications are for the rest of, because the earth is a big place, and there's a lot of things going on in energy, water, other places that are also having a lot of negative impacts, like agriculture is. So let's get into that a bit.
Sure. Well, you know, every year the World Wildlife Report comes out, and it points to all of the environmental degradation that's occurring. Pollution, simply CO2 in the atmosphere. We know it's creating global warming, therefore climate change. We know that's an amazing destructive force. We know the impact that it's having on rainforest with it's just changing the temperatures in the canopy, and some insects are dying, which is was a food source for another animal or insect or bird, and they're starting to pass. They're starting to die. So we're seeing an extinction, if you will, of wildlife on the planet. And as the population grows, we know that we're having a negative impact on that. We also know that the chemicals that we're using, we don't go a day without hearing about glyphosate, right? So those, and glyphosate is hugely popular in my industry and pretty much for almost all farming, and it is not a good chemical. So those chemicals are polluting the waterways all over the country. You know, you can read stories about the Ganges or the Yellow or the Nile, or, you know, even in this country, the Colorado. I don't think it makes it down to the Gulf anymore. So we've really stressed waterways. I was in Iowa just not too long ago, and they were telling me about how they have all these drain tiles under that beautifully rich soil, but they use so much nitrogen, it all ends up in the Mississippi and ends up going down into the Gulf and creating this huge area of hypoxia. It just kills all of the life in the soil. So these things are happening all around us. I mean, not the least of which is the loss of forest, particularly rainforest. It's just mind-boggling. It almost makes me sick to even talk about it. But in the last 25 years, I think it's 300 million acres have been removed. It's just mind-boggling. So the rainforest is it's such a critical component. As I was describing how CO2 comes down into these little plants on the plains, we can imagine how important the rainforest is to the planet, and we're losing it. You know, since I think the beginning of time, since we started removing trees, we've removed 50% of the trees on the planet. It's just really crazy. So this mindset that we have of extraction, or the planet's here for us to utilize the way we want to use it, it's just not working. And in that awful description I just created there, that picture, farming is sort of right at the heart of it. A lot of the rainforest is coming out in service of farming. A lot of the pollution is coming out, the plot of the pollution is a result of farming. So they're saying that they believe that 50% of the problem, actually I think it was 58% of the problem, has to do with farming. So I believe that there's a way, and I've spent time talking to conventional farmers about the concept of regenerative. Not the concept of organic and not the concept of biodynamic, because that just takes it too far out of the realm of possibility for them. But if you speak to them in a way that you can paint a picture of how they can build the restorative capacity in the soil naturally, using those methods that I described, they can start to see a path forward, because they know that their farms are not performing the way they want to perform because they're overgrazing or they're over-cultivating. They're losing topsoil, and they intuitively know it, but they just don't know what to do about it. They just don't have a sense. And it just takes a few little stories, a few little examples for them to, you know, just start to perk up and say, oh, that's what I can do. When you tell them, if you can increase the organic matter in your soil 1%, you can add 20,000 gallons of storage in your soil per acre. 1%. Now, I'm not saying 1% is easy to do, but it's definitely possible. And it's the way my vineyard's working now. As I mentioned, I don't have to irrigate any longer. It allows me to not have to turn on the irrigation. And, of course, that saves carbon as well. So this, if we can break this cycle of farming the way we farm, using synthetic pesticides and herbicides, fungicides, all the sides, we can start to change the direction. of and start to alter the contextual framework in which we're farming, that framework of extraction, an extraction for more, or extraction for consumption, or extraction for creating wealth, or however one would want to describe it, to a different paradigm of one of building life and building energy into the farm and into the food.
Yeah, which we didn't really get into.
No, we didn't get into that.
We probably don't have that much time. We have less than 5 minutes. So, I mean, we have like 4 minutes before we go to Q&A. So maybe actually, I think this is interesting. I think this would be interesting for people. If you can kind of march through the linkage to health, Rudolf Steiner, health, and the early years, and why there's also very important health implications to all this.
So Rudolf Steiner was a polymath. He knew a lot about a lot of things. And one of the areas where he didn't spend a lot of time in was in farming. But people were constantly asking him to come to the ranch and come share his ideas. He was a spiritual scientist, but he was a natural scientist as well. I mean, he was in both areas. But what he recognized what was missing is that spiritual side, that energic side, that energy that was missing inside of soils and was missing inside of the animals that were on those soils. So he agreed to do a series of lectures, and he did a series of about 8 lectures over 7 days. And the reason he decided to do it was he believed that there was a significant missing at that time. And he didn't believe that there was enough nutrition in the food back 100 years ago. That was missing for him. So he agreed to do this series of lectures to give us some insight in how to put that nutrition back in the soil, because he believed that in order for us, this is 100 years ago, almost 100 years ago, to be able to tackle the issues that we're dealing with today, we were going to need to have a more expanded consciousness and a more expanded awareness of what it was that we were doing and what it was that was missing. And he felt that that was going to come through food. So that's why he created this series of lectures, just to open up that there's a whole new paradigm and a whole new context for farming that could be, and explain what the difference was going to be as a result of that.
Okay. I think I'd like to open it up now, because I think we can have interesting set of conversation with people. So, sure, yes.
Your example is one of perennials with cover crops. If you have a farm which is mostly annuals, say corn, something like that, you would create maybe cover crops to enrich the soil, but then you're planting the corn to extract it.
Yeah,
how do you do the equivalent of the 20-foot roots?
Deep roots, yeah.
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 In an annual.
Those are vines versus the annual.
Yeah.
Well, there's a I mentioned that I was back in Iowa not too long ago, and it was for a particular purpose. But what I had a chance to do is go out to the Iowa State Research Farms. And there was a particular project there. It was about 20 acres. It was called the Marsden Project, and it was a crop rotation project. I just assumed, we knew about crop rotation a couple hundred years ago, 300 years ago, right? I figured everybody in the Midwest was doing crop rotation. It's not true. There's two crops, soy and corn. And then the next year it's corn and soy. And then but on this particular plot, and it had 10 years of work consistent with the year before, so that replications, 10 years of replications. They discovered that if you added one other crop, and to your point, it was alfalfa, so it was a legume, and you could squeeze that in and still get your two rotations of the other, and you could squeeze that in, and what it would do is it would provide the nitrogen, but it would also reduce the amount of demand for pesticides by 80%, fertility by 80%, and herbicides by 80%, if you can imagine. And it increased the productivity of the property by 10%. from a dollar standpoint. So they were, and the other thing that they included is what they're calling conservation agriculture now, where they, instead of cultivating it in, they were just chopping the corn stalks off at the top and then seeding back over that. So a lot of the things I was talking about was maintaining cover on it and maintaining cover on the ground and not cultivating. All of those things were implemented just through that one little piece. Now, that wasn't an easy sell. It wasn't an easy sell in that part of the country, and they're still not quickly moving to crop rotations. But they're all different types of solutions in all different types of situations. Yeah.
I was going to ask you the question about Africa, but another one came up. Just this morning I read a new article that came out by Bill McKibben in the New York Review of Books, The End of Oil. And it looks like we might be saved in terms of energy just because of economics. But that's because the banks realize that alternative energy is where to go. How do you convince agriculture, agri-industry, that that's where to go?
Well, that's a great question. Well, I don't know. I don't know when the alternative energy thing started. Maybe in the 70s, we can say. And I'm sure people were talking into rooms of people that were not interested in hearing it. They didn't believe it. It's not possible. It's too small. How could you get solar power to make up for all of the energy that's provided by oil or gas? And but over time, somebody started to see it, and then somebody else started to see it, and today, it is the new investment frontier for venture capitalists, you know, solar, wind. But it doesn't blow enough, though, right? It doesn't blow often enough. Sorry, I just couldn't help myself. And it's the same kind of dynamic here. So for me, you know, sharing this with you, and I'll share it with others and others and others, and there's actually a grass-fed exchange symposium taking place up in Santa Rosa right now, actually tonight and tomorrow and the next couple of days. So the grass, the animal grazers, the cattle grazers have been exploring what they call mob grazing or intensive grazing, which I described earlier, and it's really taking hold. And it's absolutely a beautiful thing. There's a farm that I visited up in the Sand Hills up in Nebraska just a couple years ago. It's a 500 acre ranch. They run 1,600 cows on it. They've taken it from a very unhealthy few different species of grasses to the point where the grasses were 6 and 8 feet tall in some of the areas. They did this rotational grazing. They just kept building the forage and building the forage to the point now where there's 500 species of grasses at this stage of the game. And it just provides this beautiful energy for the cow. And at the same time, they're growing amazing grasses. So the opportunities are immense, and so that's in the cattle industry. You know, I'm working on it in the wine industry, but I speak to all different agricultural industries.
Just a follow up to that question: UC Davis has been a huge influence on the modern wine industry. Are they getting behind regenerative agriculture?
Well, it's not that I haven't been there. I don't know. One of my concerns in this area is Monsanto is still huge, and they provide a lot of the resources for research inside of these research institutes, college institutes, but they don't ask for regenerative research. So the amount of research in that area is so small compared to the money that's supported by the other guys.
I'm not going to totally disagree with you, but because I agree that the preponderance of research is based on the old paradigm. But there are a lot of young soil scientists. I'm working with a couple right now at UC Davis at the Ag Sustainability Institute who are really thoughtful and are part of, I think, a new generational shift that's been influenced greatly by organic agriculture and this term regenerative, resilient. So I think academia, you know, it's its own world, and it's very hard to get change there. But I do see things breaking up a little bit in certain places. And there's some of the CSUs up in Chico. There's a really great organic program for dairy and other things going up there. So there are some, and there are elements within the university that are in line. I think biodynamic is not really widely accepted, but some of the thought processes and the attention to the need to for us to perceive more deeply what's going on in agriculture, everyone's aware of that. The science is really moving. There's a great company now, Pam Marone's company, Marone Biointensive, some of you may know it. Well, you know, where they're working with natural, you know, one insect creates a compound that they can use against another insect. So basically they're mimicking nature as they're doing with grass. And she works with people at University of California, Davis and Riverside and Berkeley. So there are elements. I'm a little bit hopeful.
Yeah. Cornell's got a great program too, and Purdue and Michigan. There are some really areas of hope for sure.
So if you could wave your magic wand and pass legislation in California, or policies, I should say, California or federally, you know, maybe federally changing the insurance program, the crop insurance program, or California water storage, you know, just incentives. Any thoughts on this?
Renata?
Renata Brillinger is here from the California Climate Agriculture Network. She's running some really good legislation right now that helps move people in the right direction.
We have experts in the room to help us.
Right?
Renata's right over here.
Stand up, Renata, please.
There's a lot going on in California and a lot more that needs to happen in other states and nationally. But we are blazing a trail here. So far, there's been $300 million spent in cap-and-trade revenue on the kinds of practices Paul sketched out, the biological practices, regenerative practices. There's been some hundreds of other millions of dollars spent on propping up the dominant paradigm. So it's a constant struggle at the state to get legislators to understand that we're not going to high-tech our way out of this, that we also need to be investing in ecological solutions in agriculture. But there is a lot going on and a lot of positive leadership happening here. There's a program that funds farmers for building soil, improving soil fertility and soil health. There's a program to incentivize on-farm water conservation practices. There's a program that keeps farmland in farming permanently, so it limits sprawl, so we don't have increased vehicle miles traveled and embedded energy in our urban areas, concentrates growth in existing urban spheres. And there's a program to reduce methane emissions from livestock operations by managing manure better. So there's a lot more to be done. It's not nearly as transformative as I think we'd like to see, but it's certainly a start, and it does have the potential to ripple out across the country and around the world. So we have a lot to be proud of here and a lot more work to continue doing, and I'd be happy to talk with folks. CalCan is the organization you could Google to find a lot more of the specific policy wonky stuff on this.
I will say that I appreciate your question about insurance, because that is federal policy. We don't really have a state policy around that. That's part of the Farm Bill. And it is clear that one of the big problems that we have is that we do not tie our insurance subsidies to any kind of, well, with few exceptions, with the kinds of outcomes that all of us would like to see, and that would be a really beautiful place to make a change. But the problem is that's also the place where all the money is in the Midwest, particularly with the insurance companies and the banks and all of that. So it's incredibly difficult to change. But, you know, with climate change doing and the floods we're seeing and all the things that are happening to the farmers, You know, sometimes it takes crisis, so maybe something will happen there in the years ahead. Because there are a lot of people talking or raising the question that you raised.
I would be remiss in not mentioning, so I recently joined, it's a new startup organization. It's called ROC, or Regenerative Organic Certification. And it's a response to, one is the opportunity for regenerative and how that can be framed. And it also recognizes that in the organic world, there were some things that some of the organic farmers didn't feel comfortable with when they started to go down the aquaponics. And so this is a soil-based certification that is expanding the framework for the ecological side. It's also including animal welfare and people welfare, employee welfare. And it's really quite an amazing program. It's being developed and supported by Patagonia and Dr. Bronner, who are, I don't know if you've followed Yvonne Chouinard lately, but he's all about food these days. So it's really exciting to see something like this start to emerge. And I found myself over the last couple of years going to conferences around the regenerative business and regenerative activities and regenerative farming and regenerative activities in clothing. So from sheep and it's all the things that Patagonia would be interested in. The reason why we buy their clothes. But it's an emerging paradigm. It's really an emerging paradigm but it's getting a lot of traction. And I think I'm hopeful that it goes down the same path as alternative energy.
So you've talked quite a bit about the producer side of things, and I'm kind of curious on the consumer shopper side. So it seems there's a shift from this dichotomy of conventional versus organic to now this hierarchy of conventional, organic, biodynamic, regenerative. And how do you explain that to the average person that wants to make decisions about what food to buy?
It's not easy. It's a problem. It is a very big problem, I think. But generally, the exciting news is that there's a generational shift. I think you're probably well aware of the fact that the millennials are much more into food and care about food in a way different from the generation that I came up in. And so there is a willingness and an awareness and a facileness with the ideas. So it's going to be a little bit easier for them to navigate the complexities. And also, I mean, you know, organic's been around 20 years now as a federal policy, longer than that a little bit. But it takes a while, I think, for these things to shake out. And we've been in a period of, we're in a period of disruption. So I don't know where it's going to end up. I mean, this whole idea of regenerative agriculture and a certification program for that could make things maybe more complex for a while, but it actually might resolve some of the issues because it looks at all those things and puts them under one umbrella, which could be helpful. It's a tough problem. I don't think it's an easy problem for a marketer. But also, we live in this age where there are a million different choices for everything. I mean, look at the television. So I think we're just in this phase, and I think it's part of the evolution of what's going on. We're experimenting in so many different ways, trying to figure out how to get through this next 100 years, particularly in the farming world. And so that's as much as I can give you because I don't have a clear answer.
Well, on some level, I think it got sorted out. You've seen how organic's grown. I mean, it's significant. It's 20% a year for a number of years now, and I really believe consumers are smart, you know, and we're smart in the room, and we'll sort it out. You go to events like this. We're interested. We're curious. The next generation we find is really very curious, and it's easy for them to pick up information and new ideas and. They sort it out really, really quickly. And we know that generation, the millennials, is moving pretty quickly in this regard. At least that's what my millennial tells me.
I think we're just, I'm being told we're kind of at the end of our time for our conversation, but I know you're both going to stick around for about 15 minutes afterwards. But I want to thank you both for coming. It's been an incredible night. As we wrap up here, do you have any... Yeah, thank you. As we wrap up, what any tips, things we can do as consumers or advocates for this type of farming that can help promote what you're doing? I think we talked about consumer and demand, and so much is driven by demand. Any tips, simple things we can do at home or with our families that can kind of plant a seed, so to speak?
Just tell everybody tomorrow, you just went to this amazing talk on regenerative. It's the next new trend, and it's we all got to get on board. I want to tell you that the red wine is from Dark Horse. It's from our vineyard, so it's a biodynamic red wine, and the Chardonnay is an organic Chardonnay from Sonoma County.
Well, thank you, everyone.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you for coming, and we hope to see you next month. Thank you.